We're talking this segment about the Sundance Institute Native Film Series, which runs at the Jean Cocteau Cinema here in Santa Fe today through Sunday. Joining us by phone are Bird Running Water, who is director of the Sundance Institute's Native American and Indigenous program, filmmaker Sterling Harjo, whose new documentary is This May Be the Last Time, and filmmaker Sydney Freeland, writer and director of the film Drunk Town's Finest. Both of them premiered at the Sundance Film Festival in January, and all three of our speakers will be here in Santa Fe in the coming days. Welcome to the Radio Cafe.
Yeah, thank you for having us.
Thank you.
So, Bird Running Water, let's start with you. This program that you are the director of is celebrating its 20th anniversary this year. How did it begin?
Well, the Sundance Institute's program is celebrating our 20th anniversary, but the commitment to supporting Native filmmakers has really, actually really predates the Institute, thanks to the commitment of our founder and our president, Robert Redford. You know, he's always had a particular passion of working with Native communities and being connected to Native communities, and has really made it part of his life's work to support Native filmmakers. And when he founded Sundance Institute back in 1981, you know, he mandated that the Institute would serve the Native filmmaking community. But it wasn't really up until maybe 20 years ago that that the Institute brought on Native staffers to really, you know, dig deep and to really carry out this line of work with the Native community. So, you know, that's really kind of, while we're celebrating, you know, a historical commitment, you know, it's really been 20 years, I think, that we've been able to see, I think, some of the greatest strides that have really been made in Native film.
You know, that's the thing I was going to ask you, was how the program has evolved over these decades. And I guess one of the ways is more and more Native people and every part of the organization and the filmmakers, film crews, everything.
Yeah, well, you know, I think back when, you know, 40 years ago, whenever Mr. Redford tried to first work with Native filmmakers, you know, our communities were really in a different place, and I don't think that there were as many people thinking about filmmaking, you know, as an option or a career, you know, because our communities were in such a different place politically and socially, and we were, you know, just coming out of the termination era and moving into kind of the era of self-determination and how tribes were being dealt with, you know, at a political level. And I think ever since that time frame, you know, moving forward nowadays, you know, we have more filmmakers working than ever before. You know, we had close to 140 artists who applied for our Native Lab Fellowship last round, which is a national competition that we have. And I, you know, can't say that that's really everyone in the community, but that's a pretty significant number. And, you know, and so there's just so many people out there who, and I think a lot of it due to, you know, access of digital technology and just kind of the proliferation of how people consume content based on the web and iPhones and, you know, whatnot, that I think people are being much more inspired, especially younger generations, to take up storytelling in any format.
How does the kind of storytelling that happens in film mirror or not the kind of storytelling that is part of different Native traditions?
Well, I think that there's definitely cross-pollination from both, you know, because, I mean, traditionally Native people, you know, we come from storytelling cultures, you know, we didn't really traditionally have, you know, written forms of conveying stories and information. Everything was always done, you know, orally and through storytelling. And so I feel like it's such an inherent part of every person who really comes from a Native community that there's just kind of a tradition of telling stories to relay information. I think if you kind of merge that with digital technology and filmmaking and really trying to convey, you know, stories, you know, in that particular format, I think it's a really unique and interesting merging of forms, you know. And I think some of the work that we're able to see that really exemplifies that, our work, like, that is being presented by Sterling Harjo and by Sydney Freeland, you know, two of the Native American filmmakers who had films premiere at Sundance this year.
What are some of the best-known films that have come from this program?
Yeah, wow, in over 20 years. well, I think one of the first projects that Sundance got behind that ended up being seen by really wide audiences was back in 1998, a feature film called Smoke Signals, which was a film written by Sherman Alexie, who's an acclaimed author and poet. And the film was directed by Chris Eyre, who is a filmmaker as well. And both of those filmmakers participated in the Sundance Labs, probably going back to 1995 or so. And, you know, that was kind of one of the first feature films written, produced, and directed by Native people that was able to, you know, to garner major distribution and to be seen, you know, in the marketplace across the United States. And ever since then, you know, we've also had other filmmakers have come along, like Sterling's work and Andrew Opiaha McLean's work, and, you know, and then some of the international filmmakers that we've been able to work with, like Taika Waititi, you know, have all made feature films that have, you know, been shown in theaters across the country as well.
I would think that just as important are the other films, maybe that haven't gotten as much distribution or that are shorts or whatever, but that serve as training for filmmakers and writers and crews.
Well, yeah, you know, I think that's one of the ways that a lot of filmmakers really kind of come up, you know, in terms of a more traditional means of becoming a director, I think, is to participate, you know, in the production level, what different levels of production. And it seems to me like, I feel like New Mexico and Oklahoma really seem to have kind of some of the more richer, kind of developed kind of places for Native crew and people working on the crew side to be working.
Now, you also have programs in New Zealand and Australia, I read?
Yeah, in the past, we have, back when I first came on board with the program about 13 years ago, I had already been doing global work because of my previous jobs. And so when I took over the program, I had, you know, visited other countries where I had really witnessed, you know, indigenous participation within national popular cultures in places like Australia and New Zealand and Canada, and really was really quite envious of kind of this presence of an indigenous perspective that was really constantly present, you know, within national media in these particular countries. And so one of the things I wanted to do was really to internationalize the Native program and to really support those filmmakers working in those countries and kind of create more of an international network of indigenous filmmakers that could be supportive of one another. So we launched a writer's lab in New Zealand for Maori writers. We also launched a writer's lab and a director's lab in Australia for Aboriginal filmmakers there. And some really great films came out of it. And it really kind of allowed us to expand our networks and really build more of an international community.
Has there been a kind of cross-pollination between filmmakers from those countries and those from North America?
There has. You know, there have been a lot of, there's a really significant indigenous kind of, what I would call an indigenous film festival circuit. You know, you have festivals like Imaginative in Toronto. You had what formerly used to be known as Message Sticks, which was held at the Sydney Opera House in Australia. And, you know, and there are a couple of festivals in New Zealand. And a lot of these film festivals show indigenous work from a lot of different countries and really kind of create community, you know, amongst them. And it's, I think part of the thing that's really interesting is, I think to really see, I think beyond that indigenous network, how a lot of these indigenous films travel to, you know, like Sterling has had a film that played at the Venice Film Festival, you know, his film Barking Water, and Taika Waititi has won top awards at the Berlin Film Festival with his films, and he's a Maori filmmaker that we've supported through Sundance. You know, you have Samson and Delilah, Warwick Thornton's film coming out of our lab in Australia, which won the top Best First Feature Prize at the Cannes Film Festival, you know, and Andrew McLean's film On the Ice, which won the Best First Film Prize at the Berlinale. So you see, like, a really interesting international traveling of so many of these great indigenous films. It's really exciting to watch.
It is exciting. It's exciting on multiple levels for me because, I mean, so many non-Native people are getting a kind of filmmaking and a kind of perspective on lives and on stories that they've never had before. And also, and I'd love to talk about this with Sydney and Sterling as well, but Bird, how do you feel that the program and the proliferation of films that's come out of it have affected Native communities?
Well, I think one of the issues we've really kind of identified from my program's perspective is, like I mentioned, you know, so many of these films, great films, are really traveling the world and winning top top prizes at all of these, you know, some of the world's best film festivals, including Sundance. But one of the problems that I really acknowledge is that so many of our local communities don't really know that a lot of these films are out there and that a lot of these filmmakers are really putting out such great work because of the way that the American film distribution marketplace works. You know, we're really dominated by big budget studio pictures that play all the multiplexes across the U.S. And sadly, so many of our, you know, wonderful little art films don't really, a lot of people won't take risks with them to put them into theaters, you know, to especially serve that native audience. And so I think one of the things that's really great right now about, you know, the web is online distribution. It's something that we have here at Sundance through our artist services program. And it's something that makes films much more accessible to native audiences. But I, you know, whenever we host what we do public programs and community screenings across the country where we do take films to, you know, tribal audiences and local audiences, there's always such a great response and always such great appreciation for the artistry and for the representation that people feel is really authentic and original and true to form that we're able to put in front of them.
Very much so. Let's go over to Sterling Harjo, who is joining us by phone. His new documentary is This May Be the Last Time. It screens on Thursday, the 21st of August at 6:30 at the Jean Cocteau Cinema. Welcome.
Thank you. Have a nice.
So this documentary I found just fascinating. It's about the Muskogee hymns, Christian hymns, that have been sung for generations in Oklahoma. How did you come to make this film?
It was a story that I'd always wanted to tell just because I grew up with these songs, and these songs are, you know, whether you're a Christian or whether you're a traditional person within the Muskogee Creek people or Seminole people, we speak the same language. It didn't matter because these songs are always sung at funerals, and so everyone hears them. They become more of a kind of Muskogee Creek Seminole element to culture other than just being Christian. And I was just interested in the history of the songs because I grew up with them, and I would always put them in, I've made fictional films up until this film, and I would always use these songs in my films for the soundtrack or have people singing them in them. I just think they're really beautiful. And I was just really interested in the history. And as I started learning more about the history, I started thinking, you know, wow, I could probably tell the story of the history of these songs. And, you know, it's a little different because it's also about, I tell it through a personal lens, which is the story of my grandfather who went missing. And it was this story that I'd heard growing up. And whenever my grandma would tell me the story, she always talked about the songs that were sung. And I knew what songs she was talking about. She was talking about these hymns. And, you know, so it was just, I also wanted to, no one had really ever tackled the, it's sort of like a no-no taboo thing, I believe, to talk about Christianity and the influence of Christianity within Native people. And, you know, I just wanted to see the effects that Christianity had on this community and kind of how they took those effects and made them their own. And, you know, and in the film, I don't pass judgment either way on religion at all. It's just, you know, this is kind of the story of what happened to this these people that were forcibly removed from their homes in Alabama and Georgia and Mississippi and moved to Oklahoma. And really, it's, you know, the songs for me are about hope, and that's what I wanted the film to be about hope.
The sound of these songs is really profound. I mean, it sounded to me like a hybrid of Christian and indigenous music and then a little bit of black spiritual as well. And it turned out all these things are in there. Tell us about the origins of these songs.
Yeah, I mean, you actually just hit it on the head. I mean, it's the songs, the thing that's so interesting about the songs is that they are a direct mix of, in the Southeast at that time, you had Scottish missionaries, you had black slaves, and you had Native people. And they were sort of mixing, and they were sharing basically traditions with each other culturally. And the one way that missionaries identify and try to, like, really get in with the Native people are through songs. And honestly, the Christian religion didn't really take off in the early days. But what the Indians did take was the song, the style of singing that they brought. And because of the influence and the close proximity to African American people, that style of singing also mixed it. And a lot of times you would have these little groups and they would be singing together, and it would be, you know, it'd be black people and it'd be Indian people, and they would sing. So the style of singing really evolved out of that. And then we had our own traditional songs that also influenced these songs. And I think that you can really hear it, especially there's a couple songs on the trailer where you could hear it, where it's like you have these like bluesy kind of tones and kind of moaning that you would hear in a slave spiritual, and you have the rhythmic sort of like line singing of the European Scots songs, but then you also have this really low sort of bravado that we use in our traditional songs whenever we sing our traditional songs. And so it's just a really fascinating story about how this style of music developed out of the cross-cultural exchange between these three groups of people. And I think that they didn't realize that there's only a few people that sing like this. And I kind of wished I'd told that a little more in the film, but I didn't, and I don't know why, but whatever. There's not a lot of people that sing like that other than the Muscogee Creek people. And we took it and we brought it to Oklahoma, and it sort of incubated and survived here. And so it was lost to history. No one really knew, you know, until this film really talks about the connection, you know. So, and the songs are pretty much, you know, they've stayed alive, and they've helped save the Muscogee language, and they're thriving, I would say.
It's really interesting to me because it makes you kind of think about how cultures mix and influence each other. And it's sort of like when there's a singing tradition already there and another one comes in, it sort of builds on the original one and can be absorbed, as opposed to being like just only a colonial overlay.
Yeah, totally. And, you know, I mean, that's really what, I mean, it's so evident in the film, you know, when you hear the African American singers, or you hear the Scottish singers in the film, and you hear them a lot because you've been listening to the Indian songs the whole film, and then when these other singers come in, it really just kind of makes sense, and you can put the pieces together really easy on how that happened. I think that the South in general, I mean, you know, the blues and jazz and everything has Native influence in it, but it's something that's not ever talked about in history books, the history of music. But these forms of music were created where my people are from, and it is influenced, and part of our tradition with folk music, blues, whatever, is no one really authored these songs, you know? Like, you just shared them, and people learn these, like, even old cowboy songs. People learn these songs and they shared them, and then you sang a song, and if you remembered who taught it to you, you told people, like, this guy taught me this song, you know? You don't know if he wrote it or not, but you know who you learned it from. And so it's a similar thing, and I think that that's how, you know, one way in which these songs evolved. And it's the whole oral tradition that Bert's talking about. And, you know, people in rural America that weren't indigenous also had that oral storytelling is really important to them. And it's like, that's what they do. That's their entertainment, you know. So I think it was just kind of a perfect storm of a situation where these songs were able to thrive and basically be invented.
Yeah, yeah. Now, the film is built around an incident that you mentioned a moment ago that happened with your grandfather, Pete Harjo. He disappeared. There was a car wreck, and family and friends and community were looking for him. What was the role of song around that whole incident?
I'm sure if we were there today watching what was going on, I'm sure we would only hear a couple times in singing these songs, you know, in reality. But through my memory growing up, for some reason, that's what I always really held on to when my grandma would tell me that story. And I've heard that story 100,000 times, and I've had her tell it to me every which way. And every time she talks about them singing these songs. So for me, it was just a personal thing of like, you know, I remember my earliest days hearing these stories, and I remember that that's what I was interested in, the songs, you know. But it talks to a bigger story of how, you know, in struggle and in hard times, people do sing these songs because they're encouraging. And when you're at your lowest point and you feel like there is no hope, you can sing these songs and, you know, they're supposed to make you feel better.
Are they still sung? Are younger people still going to these churches? Are they still learning these songs?
Yeah, they are. I mean, you know, it's not as cool to go to church anymore. I feel like some people just hear them at funerals, but people do learn them, and I made it a point to learn them. I made it a point to learn my traditional songs and these songs. And part of me, and right now our traditional religion and ceremonies are really thriving. They're really doing awesome. And these churches are really dying out, a lot of them. Right. And a thing that would be heartbreaking to me is if we lost these songs. And so for me, this film was to kind of just put a spotlight on these songs and say, whether you're a Christian or not, look how beautiful these songs are and look how they're used. And hopefully encourage people to sing them more, because there's not as many people singing them. But to this day, like, I could sing you a song, or I could drive you 30 minutes from my front porch and you would have someone that could sing you a song. So they're not dying, or they're not dead, and they're not close to dying, but if something isn't done, they'll be gone.
And there's some wonderful characters whom you interview and who are featured in this film. And I thought it was also just a kind of really beautiful way that you did the cinematography in this film. There's so much, I mean, it's a story about music, but there's so much nature and water and sky and insects and things like that that somehow seem to go along with it very, very naturally.
Yeah, well, thank you. I mean, you know, it's a very rural area where we grew up, and I feel, when I think of these songs, I don't think of them. You know, I don't think of, like, a metropolitan city. I don't think of standing in downtown Tulsa or New York City. I think of these really backwoods. I mean, all these churches are in the middle of nowhere. You probably have to have someone local take you to them. And you just step into these worlds, and all of a sudden, it's a totally different world than you're used to. You know, like, I had crew members that had never been to these places before, and they were just really blown away at how welcoming everyone was, but how this culture had survived, and how it's so unique and there's nothing like it, you know. And how it is. And part of me, for the film, for me, is partly about community and how people really need to pull together more and help each other. And the evidence of what happened with my grandfather, the whole community came together and searched for my grandpa. And the sad thing is, I don't know if that would happen today. So for me, it was kind of, you know, it was just showing, like, that rural Oklahoma kind of coming together and people of all races coming together to help find someone. And for me, a way to visually tell that story is through nature and things like that.
Now, have a lot of people from your area, I mean, people who sing these songs or whose ancestors did or whatever, have seen the film?
They haven't. There's actually one guy that's taken one of the guys from the film has a burned copy of the DVD, and he's been taking it to churches and showing people. But other than that, it hasn't really played here a lot. It's playing in a couple weeks for one screening, and then in November it's going to open in Oklahoma, so people will get a chance to see it then.
We're going to take a little break, but before we go, let's hear a little clip from Sterling Harjo's film, This May Be the Last Time.
My grandma Johnny May's favorite song was Espogeres Omes Kithiskos. It translates to, this may be the last time, we don't know. When she was dying, we sang it to her. She wasn't really conscious, but we noticed that when we'd sing it, she would tap her finger to the beat of the song. I remember hearing her talking about the song when she was well. She would say, that's my song. It's a song I grew up hearing as an Indian song, though the rhythm always felt a little different from the others. I never knew why. But a quick search will lead you through music history. The song comes out of the 1800s. At some point, it was a slave spiritual. The song then travels through gospel and blues adaptations. In the 1960s, the Staple Singers have a hit with it. Keith Richards then hears it and adapts it into the Rolling Stones song, The Last Time. It's not recorded when it was first sung in the Muskogee language. But it hasn't changed from the original version. For most things in Native communities, change isn't necessarily looked at as a good thing. It can represent loss, loss of culture, and loss of the way things used to be. Graveside. None of the elders had gotten out of the car because it was so hot that day. Frank Maupin was the preacher and we were about to lower the casket. Frank started singing a Creek hymn. There was nothing but young people there, so when Frank began to sing, no one could sing along. No one knew the songs. I realized then how few people were actually learning them.
And we're back talking about the Sundance Institute Native Film Series, which is happening at the Jean Cocteau Cinema. Well, let's go now to Sydney Freeland, who is joining us by phone. She is writer and director of the film Drunk Town's Finest, which premiered at the Sundance Festival in January and screens every night through Saturday of this week at the Jean Cocteau Cinema. A wonderful film. Welcome.
Thank you for having me.
So this film was shot in New Mexico, and it just has such a New Mexico feel to it. I'm guessing that it's all New Mexico places and people as opposed to sets and actors. Is that true?
Yeah. It was definitely, it was a low-budget film, so we weren't able to shoot on sets or anything like that. But it's, I was born and raised in Gallup, New Mexico, which is where the film is based on. So we shot in Gallup, in Santa Fe, in Espanola. And it was very important to sort of get the location, the feel and the vibe of the location was a big part of the story. So it was always, it was always something from the beginning that we wanted to shoot in New Mexico.
There are three characters in this story they're all very different from each other, but they have stories that intersect actually quite gracefully over the course of the movie. How did you develop each of these three? Are they based on people that you know or types of people?
The genesis of the story came from, my experiences growing up on the Navajo Reservation. I'm Navajo myself. And so growing up, I never really felt like I saw the people and the places that I knew represented on film. So, when I went to film school and I started developing scripts and ideas and everything, one of the ideas I had was this story about, quote unquote, this place called Drunktown. And wouldn't it be interesting if we showed a different side of it? And so one thing I wanted to do was I wanted to try to show how diverse this location is and how diverse this community is. And the way I sort of landed on that was to create three different characters. And these three different characters represent the three different extremes in the community. So it's like through them, you get to see how the community sort of interacts and intersects with each other. And that's sort of where that idea came from.
One of the characters is a transsexual person who is played by a transsexual Navajo actor, if I have that correct. Is that right?
Yes, that is correct. One of the lead characters is a transgender Navajo woman who is played by Carmen Moore, who is Navajo, who is transgendered. Yeah, you know, I was very fortunate to have found her. I feel like she brought a sort of a depth and an authenticity and a realism to the character that was, you know, that was very important for me going into the production.
It was one of the things that I thought was so moving about this film was how completely non-judgmental her family was about her.
Yeah. One of the, without giving too much away about the film, you know, there is this sort of, this part of the Navajo mythology where there's a place in the society for LGBT people, which I thought was very interesting, you know. So even though on the reservation, the mindset tends to be very conservative, or, you know, it tends to be conservative, but because these grandparents did practice sort of more traditional, way of life, to me, it just made sense that, yeah, they would be loving and they would be accepting of their granddaughter, you know. And so that was something that was, I thought it was a unique little twist that was sort of specific to the area.
How long did you work on the film?
It took 6 years of writing and rewriting. A lot of that, you know, as Bird can probably tell you, is sort of, especially having three characters in a story, you know, it definitely changes the dynamic because you have to try to get all these storylines to interact and intersect with each other. But in order to arrive at a place that hopefully feels organic and natural, you have to go down a lot of blind alleys and you have to sort of write a lot of bad stuff before you hopefully get to the good stuff. So it took 6 years of writing and rewriting, and then it took 1 year of pre-production, production, and post-production.
Very interesting. So much of it was involved in the writing. Could you talk a little bit about how the Sundance Institute helped you to develop the film?
Yeah, you know, well, I mean, I wouldn't be here having this conversation if it wasn't for the Sundance Institute, you know. Early on in the writing process, I was just kind of feeling my way through this whole sort of process. You know, I was just kind of writing and putting stuff on paper. And I submitted a script to the Sundance Labs. It wasn't really a Sundance story, but Bird Running Water had read it and asked if I had something else. So I just finished the first draft of Drunktown's Finest. You know, it was 181 pages, which is basically the equivalent of a three-hour movie. And, you know, to his credit, he read the script. He felt that it had potential. And so he kind of encouraged me to, like, you know, get it down shorter, get it down to something more manageable, and then submit for the Sundance Native Lab, which is a sort of satellite program of the Sundance Institute that helps develop, you know, kind of what Bert was talking about earlier, that develops Native American and Indigenous writers. So, and then once I got into the Native Lab, that's where I really sort of got the support and the structure to, like, try to make the story be the best it could be, you know, and then sort of from there, it really kind of took off. But it's definitely, I'm definitely very grateful and fortunate to have taken part of the Sundance Labs.
It's a terrific and memorable story, and I encourage everybody to go see it. It's playing at the Jean Cocteau Cinema every night through Saturday of this week at 8:30. And this may be the last time. Sterling Harjo's documentary is screening on Thursday at 6:30 in the evening. And I wanted to go back to you, Bird Running Water, before we go. Talk for a moment about the extent to which the Native film industry is becoming self-sufficient and how much it's still reliant on, for example, Los Angeles for the infrastructure of filmmaking.
That's a great question. Well, you know, I have to say, you know, like, the filmmaking culture of Los Angeles, I don't find is particularly integrated with the Native film community working in the U.S., mostly because, you know, Los Angeles is really rooted in kind of the studio culture, the television network culture, and those are, like, you know, these self-sustaining kind of corporate entities that are really churning out content that's, you know, intended for mass consumption. I feel like, you know, a lot of the work that Sundance does and that the Native program supports is really about independent film. It's all really about people who are working outside of those mainstream structures to tell really, you know, unique and authentic stories that probably wouldn't ever really be considered for support by, you know, by a lot of these, you know, corporate entities in Los Angeles. So one of the things that we've had to do in the past, you know, with Sterling's feature films and with Sydney's films, you know, is really try to look for alternative means of financing and funding and support. And thankfully, you know, both Sterling and Sydney share the same producer. His name is Chad Burris, and he's based in Santa Fe. Chad belongs to Chickasaw Nation, and so he's been, like, I think one of the most resourceful, you know, independent producers out there, who's really gotten the most number of Native films financed and made just through his own personal connections to people who have, you know, equity finance and who happen to have little bits and pieces of money lying around that they're able to back these really great films with. And so, you know, thanks to people like him and also the communities that Sterling and Sydney come from, where they're really able to call on favors, you know, for friends in Oklahoma and New Mexico who, like I mentioned earlier, who work on crew and who work in different levels and capacities of production, you know, to really come on board and really support the passion that they have for trying to get their stories told.
And what about distribution? I mean, you spoke earlier about the various different ways that people are consuming content. Of course, a lot of people want free content if they're looking at stuff on their computer or on their phones. But what is it like now at this moment for film distribution, particularly independent Native film distribution in the various existing media?
Yeah, that's kind of one of the biggest challenges I feel like we have, and I think mostly because, you know, a lot of the independent film world, the whole distribution arm of the indie world, you know, they're ultimately profit driven. You know, they want to make a profit and get a return on whatever purchase price that they buy an independent film for, and a lot of times, you know, their profit margins are really determined by these pre-existing formulas that they have for releasing films out to, you know, the art house audience across the U.S., which is generally, you know, they've identified as being primarily white, you know, more upper middle class, you know, people who are above a certain financial threshold and who are really kind of really heavily pocketed in particular areas like New York, L.A., San Francisco, and, you know, there are different tiers of the marketplace. One of the things I think is really interesting about Santa Fe is Santa Fe has the greatest number of independent art house theaters per capita in the nation.
Yeah.
You know, and I think that's so fascinating. I would love to try to, you know, like we are doing with Drunk Town's Finest, you know, it's getting a 1 week run there at the Jean Cocteau. So I'm hoping that audiences will come out and support it. But, you know, it's one of the things that, you know, I think Sterling has experienced and other filmmakers have experienced coming to Sundance is, you know, it's a really difficult market to watch films being acquired for distribution, for theatrical distribution specifically, because it seems to be happening less and less. The theatrical marketplace is crowded, overcrowded every year with more than 700 films being released, you know, in American theaters, which is almost more than two a day. And very few of them get a week-long run or a two-week-long run and enough time for word of mouth to build a steady audience. And so, you know, we have to try to be innovative, I believe, with our Native films and really trying to pocket high Native population areas. And I think combining that with a good online distribution strategy. But you're right, you know, a lot of people want things for free, but unfortunately a lot of these films do have debt and financiers that, you know, they have to pay back who were when they were lucky enough to get people to invest in their films.
Would Sterling and Sydney like to comment a little bit on the question of distribution?
Yeah, I mean, you know, I could talk all day about distribution of my films because it's been the one thing that's been the hardest. You know, right now we're with a company called Bond, and you know, it's like it's more geared towards the current situation, which is you know, there's online distribution, there's, you know, DVD distribution, and it's really a way to, like, there's companies out there now that are kind of like self-distribution, but they help sort of foster all of that and curate it basically and help you mine the new world of distribution and getting your film out. I mean, I feel like, unfortunately, my film career hit, like, it was basically like, if you compare it to the music industry, it was like the year after Napster came on board, you know? So like, I feel like that's when my career, I started getting these films, and it was this, it was really, really a letdown to be getting good reviews and people love your film, and then no distributor will take it on. And if they do, you know, they're definitely not paying anything, and they're, and you just kind of see your film, and then, like, the company gets sold, and then you see your film just shelved or whatever. You know, it's a really difficult time. And it's also, and right at this point, people are really scrambling to figure out not just native films, but all across the board, how do you distribute films? Because basically the middle, that middle class of filmmaker is gone, where used to, you know, you could get a couple million dollars to make a film. Well, that's almost gone now. Like, people are either making them for 40 million, 50, 60, 80 million and up, or they're making them for 100,000 below. So it's like, there's such a big gap there of like what people are comfortable with investment wise to make their money back. And unfortunately, it's just a really hard thing for the whole film industry. But then you throw in the fact that there's this stigma towards native cinema. And there's this attitude that people don't want to see films about native people. But if you look out through, if you look through history, I mean, people are fascinated with Native America, you know, and natives on film. I mean, we were some of the first people on film. So, you know, it's an industry. It's like, how do you change minds? Well, the only way that you can really change minds is have a film that crosses over. And Smoke Signals did that to a degree. But it also came at a time when independent film was like king at that point. It was, everybody had an independent film being made. And it came at the right moment, and it made its money back, and it made more money back. It didn't blow anything out of the water. And the real downfall is that there wasn't another film to come out right after that to pick up that, the momentum that Smoke Signals started. I mean, there was just a lag, and it was kind of, there was a silence out there. There were no native filmmakers making films right after that. I mean, I feel like I came out like, I mean, I was in high school when Smoke Signals came out. So it was a while before I made Four Sheets to the Wind. I'm not sure anything was made in between there. So
yeah,
there was just a missed opportunity there, and we're still waiting on something to really hit. But, you know, and then you have the dilemma of, you have these filmmakers that don't want to make, they, you know, it's really dangerous to, like, write a film that you feel like is going to be broad and that everyone's going to love, because you feel like you're not being truthful. And as native filmmakers, we are constantly faced with our image being put out there as native people and it not being truthful. So that's the main thing that we want to fight against, is putting images of ourselves out there that aren't truthful. And so it's really scary, I think, for any native filmmaker to write something that's to please the masses, because that doesn't feel truthful, and it goes against everything that we want to be a filmmaker for. It goes against all of that. And so we you know, it's like this delicate thing of, there needs to be a crossover where the person doesn't have to basically sell their soul to make it. And it will happen. It'll eventually happen. But in the meantime, I think that most people, most of us, just keep trying to make our films and not worry about, you know, that the film industry in which we work isn't really interested. So,
yeah, I mean, the what you're talking about has to do, among other things, when you were talking about there's no mid-level films anymore. I mean, this is the phenomenon of being alive in America today. Everything in the middle is eroding. There's virtually no middle class anymore. There's no mid-level positions. It's sort of becoming this, the rich and the poor, in every field. It's extraordinary.
Oh, for sure. And I mean, I think that, yeah, I mean, you see it across the board for sure.
Sydney Friedland, I was wondering if you could talk a little bit about your experience of the distribution of your film. I mean, you're still pretty much in the festival circuit, or where are you at with Drunktown's Finest?
Yeah, you know, it's been, this whole process has very much been a sort of a learning experience. I live and work in Los Angeles in film production, so I'm familiar with the production side of the industry, but getting into Sundance and everything has been this sort of crash course in the business side of the industry, you know. So obviously, you know, like the big thing about getting into Sundance was trying to get distribution. And so we went to Sundance. We sold the international rights to the film. We've just recently, in the past couple of weeks, we've done a deal with a French theatrical distribution company. So the film is going to play theatrically in France in 20 to 30 theaters, and which is something that, you know, I wouldn't have even thought of in my wildest dreams. But then you have here in the United States, you know, one of the most common responses we've gotten from U.S. distributors is, oh, there isn't a market for Native American cinema, which, you know, there's 5 million Native Americans in the United States. So, I would respectfully disagree with that. And yeah. So, but part of where we're at right now is trying, like Sterling's saying, you know, we're trying to connect this audience with this content. And, you know, hopefully do it in a way where, you know, people can go and see these films. So, you know, so right now we're, you know, the film is going to play theatrically. There's a lot of stuff going on, you know, sort of behind the scenes with my producer, Chad Burris, who also produced Stone's film. And so we're, you know, we're sort of kind of piecemealing this thing together. And then hopefully it will have a chance to sort of, you know, be shown theatrically and people have a chance to see it. So. Yeah, it's definitely been a learning experience.
It's sort of irritating when you hear statements like, there's no market for Native American cinema. It's sort of like they make it true by saying it. Like, if they were to distribute it, they would see that maybe there was a market for Native American cinema. I mean, the two films that we've been talking about today, particularly Drunk Town Finest, it's a narrative film that people would want to see. And I think that anybody who's even remotely interested in music would want to see This May Be the Last Time. And so it's like, oh, there's no market because they say there's no market. It's sort of like they say, oh, in order to have a successful film, you have to have a bunch of 15-year-old boys going on Friday night for the film to be successful in the multiplex, as if that were the only way that a film could be successful.
Yeah, well, that's kind of what I was talking about earlier. So many of these kind of predetermined, you know, formulas that I think, you know, a lot of people are just really, I think, you know, executives are just kind of a little maybe lazy and just really trying to define new formulas. And so, you know, I think that's one of the things I want to look at with our producers initiative that we have here at Sundance, which is to really try to find some really great entrepreneurial producers, you know, who might be willing to take a stab at just kind of creating some very, you know, new specific formulas for distributing Native film.
Well, the Sundance Native Film Series is running at the Jean Cocteau Cinema here in Santa Fe through Saturday. I want to thank you all so much for joining us this hour on the Santa Fe Radio Cafe. Bird Runningwater, director of Sundance Institute's Native American and Indigenous program, filmmaker Sterling Harjo, his new documentary is This May Be the Last Time, and filmmaker Sydney Freeland, who wrote and directed Drunk Town's Finest, all of them at the Jean Cocteau Cinema. For more information, you can go to jeancocteaucinema.com. Thank you all so much for being with us on the Radio Cafe.
You know, Sterling and Sydney are going to be in Santa Fe promoting their films there at the Jean Cocteau. But on Friday, they're also going to be participating in a panel at MOCNA from 5 to 7, which is the Museum of Contemporary Native Art. And I'll be there moderating, where we're going to be discussing a lot of what we've talked about today, but really kind of about their, you know, what they see as the future of Native film.
Yes, thank you for reminding us of that. And we will see you this weekend, and we will see you at the Museum of Contemporary Native Art. Thank you all so much for being with us on the Radio Cafe.
Thanks so much.
Thank you.
Yeah, thank you for having me.